Well, you know, thank you very, very much. Wonderful, of course. But in a way, you're teaching to the converted, as far as I'm concerned, because we both believe in this. With one question, I think the statement that inflation effects of depreciation on
inflation
currency
effects of what?
Inflation effects on currency depreciation are patently small. I really have serious problems with that statement, and we can come back to it. I just want to flag it as an issue, and we can have a discussion on it.
I have two questions. The other one might be for the next discussion, right? It's a, but the first question is, there's a, because you brought it up, there's a minimum wage in the United States right now, right?
How would you set the...
No, how would you set the floor? How would you set the wage? I mean, given the, that legal minimum wage, right? How would you set the wage floor? I mean, basically,
okay.
Right?
The,
I think there are two different points here. One is the reason why we say it's actually zero, because you can't force anyone to hire you. And if you're unemployed, you're going to end up with zero. So, yes, of course, we have legislation that says if you employ someone, you must pay the minimum wage. But from the point of view of the unemployed, the minimum wage is zero. Once you have a job guarantee, whatever that program pays will be the minimum wage.
So,
okay, so now the question is, where do you want to set that? I think the goal has to be to set it at a living wage. That has to be the ultimate goal. And in the United States, I think we can go to that goal immediately. Okay, exactly where is that? Well, we've got the combination of we need a monetary wage and we need a package of benefits. Okay, so if we have an adequate package of benefits, which should include health care, retirement, child care, all those things... Okay, that will be part of it. And then a monetary wage part. I don't know exactly what, once we get that package of benefits, what that would need to be. Of course, in the United States right now, this is problematic because you don't get health care, right, normally, unless you're 65. So you need much more than would be necessary if you had a decent package of benefits. So maybe you need $20 an hour now, but with a package of benefits, it might be 10. Okay, so that, ideally, that's where you want to set it. On the other hand, you don't want to set the wage a lot higher than what the current going wage is for unskilled labor. And the reason is because all private sector jobs and other public sector jobs are going to have to immediately go to the program wage and benefit package. And so it will be disruptive. It's a one-time jump. This will not cause inflation, but it's a one-time jump. All the wages and benefits are going to have to go up to that, and then prices will have to adjust. And the process could take a while, and it could be very disruptive. So ideally, living wage. Pragmatically, you don't want to disrupt things, so you might want to start with it a lot lower than that, something close to the legislated minimum wage, and then add on benefits to that to try to get it to something that people can actually live on. And, of course, in developing nations, the minimum wage often is even farther away from what is actually a living wage. And unlike the United States, they may not actually be able to provide a living wage. Not in monetary terms. I'm talking about in real terms. Okay, they are not able to produce enough to provide that living standard for everyone. So it's something you have to gradually move toward.
Thank you very much, both of you, for your stimulating presentation. And, you know, I was just trying to picture, you know, how this can apply in my country. You know, when I first saw employment guarantee schemes and that kind of stuff, I said, wow, this cannot work in my country because the issues of inflation, macroeconomic stabilization, and all that kind of stuff. But listening to your presentation, Actually, this is something that we can do. This is something that can be integrated in the national development plans. It's just that, we normally argue sometimes not from concrete evidence. You know, it's just those kind of fears that are always being flagged, that, you know, if you do this, then that, if you do this. But I think the financial crisis maybe is giving us an opportunity to try and innovate and experience on some of the things, because really, in my country, the basic principle has been that it is the private sector which should really do provide most of the jobs and not government, because we went through a structural adjustment programs where there was massive retrenchment and telling people, you know, that now again we need this employment, you know, it would be something that would raise eyebrows. But, looking from the financial crisis point of view, and the fact that we now know that these neoliberal policies of liberalization and all that kind of stuff, we know that actually in reality, government has got a role. And if there is anything that we should really press for, it's the employment or creation of jobs for people, because we have a lot of people who are not having jobs. But on the other hand, you don't want to increase the fiscal deficit because you say, oh, it's going to be inflationary and all that kind of thing. So for me, it has been an interesting thing that I have learned, and I hope it's something that I should experiment on. But I know there will be a lot of, but it's something worth trying.
If I we just can keep the questions specific to Argentina, because I'd like to invite the other panelists back up here. So we'll come to the back and then to Echo.
Let me give a specific answer, though. We're advocating government funding of the jobs. These are not necessarily government jobs. The jobs that we looked at in Argentina were not government jobs. The government paid the wages, but the community created the jobs, okay? So we're not advocating a huge expansion of the government into all aspects of the economy. The government only funds the wages.
And here's another way that you might be able to sell it. When we look at the Argentinian case, a lot of the jobs were actually micro-enterprises. But you see, you don't get a loan to set up shop. You actually get a government wage, paid wage, and then you get some support for materials. And some people that we spoke with, they said, you know, we sell output, we save 10%, we reinvest in the microenterprise. So it is like a government, it's a microenterprise funded with a government grant. Now, when do you phase that out? You know, how do you phase that out? That's a question you have to study. But it does seem to work in a different way. And, you know, there has been a considerable criticism of traditional micro, financing schemes. This one seems to have worked. So you could also sell it on self-sufficiency basis, right?
I have a question and a comment regarding your presentation on Argentina. Question regards, you have mentioned that women gain respect from the society, from family, for children, and so on. So does it mean that as I guess, those women get low-qualified jobs, and it was not connected with high positions or something like that. So which aspects were connected the respect that they gain in society? Why do we are respected? Because in my country, I'm from Georgia, former Soviet Republic, respect of women that is connected from job is connected closely with position, with prestigious mm-hmm. jobs, and so on, so on. And then as for the comments, I wanted to add that Harshid will say the same, that in our countries, I mean transitional countries, former Soviet republics, we don't face the problem of women employment. We see the problem of employment generally. If there is no employment, there is both for men and women, you see. So women don't want any encouragement to employment if there is some programs on this. But whenever women are on labor market and when they are employed, this create another problem that we face now. This is a double burden on women. And they do have in our problem. And all this gender discrimination and all women problems that is arise, it's due to this double problem. The problem that we face in our country is now that women has less career advancement, less possibility to raise their qualification in comparison with men. So the educational level of men and women in our countries, I mean post-Soviet countries, and it's the same in Uzbekistan, I know, and in all countries that we are, we have, how to say, Soviet legacy in this regard. It is connected that on high positions there are very few representatives of women, especially on the head of department, ministries, and so on. There are many deputies, but not so many heads of some departments. And another thing that I want to add is that approximately the same program was implemented in my country, in Georgia, as the social tension was very high in our society, and government financed the salaries in various enterprises, small, medium, big, and so on. But it does not work. Government managed to do this program only for 4 months, and that was enough. Then after a year or two, they tried to repeat this program, but they failed again. So that was the story in our country.
Okay. Hi. I have a number of questions, but they actually I think I'm going to leave it for the broader panel. But I do have a specific question for you about, because I think we need to really flesh a little bit about the exchange rate. Because to the extent that the capacities of governments to implement and maintain these employment of last resort program in a sustainable way, it still goes back to the capacity to finance, right? And if the exchange rate is volatile as a and gotten increasingly volatile as a result of a financial crisis, and the IMF is warning countries, certainly in Ecuador, and same thing in Jamaica, the impact of defending your currency reserve, they're telling current countries that they need to bolster their international reserves. Now, the exchange rate volatility goes for open economy, especially vulnerable economy, goes a little bit beyond just the inflation question. It goes to the question of capital flight, of capital leaving and capital controls. Capital leaving that is not linked to the movement of goods and services and what that means for the maintenance of a domestic reserve mobilization, not just mobilization, but maintaining your domestic reserve, but also of being able to implement those programs. So I think that we need to really, I would like you to flush out a little bit about the exchange volatility impact. UNCTAD argues that what you actually really need is a constant real exchange rate. But that a constant real exchange rate cannot be maintained by one country. You're subject to a number of different kinds of issues. Therefore, it's not even regional. It's actually you need a multilateral financing facility that enables countries to be able to have to maintain constant real exchange rate. So I would like to have your feedback on that. And then later I have some other questions about how you contextualize both the India situation and the Argentinian situation on a number of levels. Thanks.
Okay. Well, look, this would be about a 12-week lecture. And there's absolutely no way to deal with all of that. A flexible exchange rate does not mean that you've got free capital flows. So one answer is that the flexible exchange rate gives you domestic policy space. You may not want to have free flows of capital. Now, I think for the United States, the UK, and so on, there is no reason to restrict the capital flows. I think we need to regulate financial institutions, all that stuff. But for developing nations, it may make perfect sense to have restrictions on capital flows as a way to try to prevent the sorts of problems that you're talking about. And just finally, because I can't possibly deal with all this, but a huge part of the volatility of exchange rates is speculators attacking exchange rate pegs. So don't peg your exchange rate. They will always be able to defeat you. That's what Soros proved. He broke the UK. If he can break the UK, he can break any country in the world. Don't peg the exchange rate. Yes, if we could have Keynes's Bancor plan or some ideal, that may be the first best exchange rate system. We're not going to get it. It's politically infeasible. What's the second best plan? Second best plan is float your exchange rate. I'm not talking about free float. I'm not saying never intervene. But you're not going to be able to maintain a peg. You give up all domestic policy if you try to peg.
Just a brief response on the respect issue to ECHA. With respect to respect and empowerment, clearly the reform suggests that women have not earned the respect for their work, right? That there are still these notions that their work is not valuable or that it's make work. What we are reporting is how women felt when they participated in the program, that they felt more connected to the community. They did feel that they earned the respect of their peers, of their children, even of their husbands. And so it's a it's again this notion of capabilities. You know, how do you define your own life and fulfillment, etc. So it's part of how they benefit. With respect to the double burden, as I said, Argentina actually did alleviate that double burden that was associated with care responsibilities. Well, there are various policies you need to implement to reduce the double burden. And we know that there are developed countries in which men actually do more unpaid care work by a few minutes. But nevertheless, this is not a panacea. We are not suggesting that the job guarantee will bring about, gender equality. But it is a meaningful institution that can help transform these. So you have to enhance your political involvement. In Argentina, women were assigned positions in the Ministry of Labor to communicate the needs of the communities and the beneficiaries to the policymakers. So there are institutional features that we need to think about to flesh out these problems.
I'd like to actually tackle the question say just a few words about the basic income guarantee that you brought up earlier, if I may. To me, to pose the issue of work the way that is understood by basic income guarantee folks, what I know anyway, or to go to ECHA's point, for example, it creates the double day. I have a very unsophisticated way of answering these questions. When I am with the basic income guarantee people, I will ask, would you give your job up tomorrow? One of my very, very good friends, for instance, Corina Rodriguez, that was here with us, she's a great supporter of basic income guarantee. We agree on many, many things. And that was the argument that shifted her away from it. Because under no circumstances would she give up her job. You see, the job is not only a vehicle of earning income. It does something else. It provides, social connectivity, essentially.
And to Eka, what I wanted to say, Eka, what I wanted to say to your argument is that you have a very valid concern about the double day. And that brings us back to an issue that I have seen resurfacing actually in some quarters in England in particular in recent times, whether work is empowering to women or not, whether entering the labor market is empowering. And to the degree that we are being exploited under bad conditions, under the double day, etc., should we be pushing actually for a greater labor force participation for women? Okay, so this is. I don't want to shut the door to that question, and I don't want to say that it is an answered one. We have answered it, and let's put it aside. But I have not met any woman, frankly, any, and maybe you have, you know, maybe other people have, but I am speaking sort of to very, very low pay workers. I am thinking of women that I met in South Africa when I was visiting, very on the older side, over 60. And there is something about work, even when it is not decent work, that puts a lot of burdens and a lot of pressures. I'm not romanticizing it at all. Not at all. But there is something that we need to explore. There is something about identity building that goes beyond the cash. And I remember, I think I mentioned it in our gathering already. I remember Amit Baduri, who was telling me, do not equate poverty with disempowerment. Empowerment comes from the ability to have a voice. And whatever allows that voice to be exercised and to push and participate in the political process and not to feel isolated. So in a way, you can be performing the same exact task. You can be taking care of your children. You could be cleaning the house. And on the other hand, you are a housekeeper to somebody else's house. And you're working under terrible conditions. I mean, nobody wants to clean somebody else's bathroom, for God's sake. Nobody wants to take care of other people's children, one would imagine. But there is something that develops there, where you can see it both in the attachment of employer-employee in these conditions, but also in the end of the working day, you pick up your income and you go home. There is something about work. I am not a sociologist. I have not spent my life really exploring this. But in a way, from an emotional and personal point of view, that is where I come from. The other comment I want to make is about the cash transfer, conditional cash transfer, related, not exactly identical to basic income guarantee, and job creation. And I will quote once again a person, a woman that you will all meet. Her name is Rocio Gaitan Garcia. She is the head, she's called the president of In Mujeres, the women's machinery in Mexico. And in a conversation that we had recently, I said to her, you know, the cash transfers, the Oportunidades program, and the Progresa program is working out for some women in Mexico. It is a good program, but I want you to also have a look at something else. And the minute we started the conversation, it was her who said, Oportunidades en Progresa is very good. It's a good program. We should have it for children. It's good for children. Why is it good for women? What happens to women after the children leave the house? What happens to women when they have to stand on the long line to receive the cash? Is it empowering to women? Not a settled question. But the answer that Corina and I have given to this is that we have to disentangle issues of employment and empowerment through employment under any conditions where you can struggle for better conditions of work, and the supplementary cash transfer that every single family should receive it if they are not at a living wage level. there should be a cash transfer for people to be moved to their living wage if existing wages through employment guarantee and everything else is not meeting it. Now, the cash transfer can come in cash or it can come in services from the government. It can come in many different forms. So sticking with this, you know, conflict, is it cash transfers? Is it employment? I think we have to move a little bit away from that, you know, clash, essentially. Thank you.
Shall I respond and then take fresh questions? Uh-huh. Okay, I would like to reply to some of the questions which were asked in the earlier session. One question was from Sergi as to who participates and what is the long-run consequence, where do they go afterwards? Participation depends on the situation, you know. It can vary from 20% to 80% of population, because if it's a poor area, dry area, then a lot of people participate. If it's an irrigated area, relatively prosperous area, then participation will be less. Also, it depends on the season. So it varies from place to place, which varies from season to season. A village sam which we had done in that village, when we inquired as to how many people are interested in participating, 80% people say they are interested in participating. Not because there was a kind of a very dry village, but also because they consider this to fill in the gaps that they have in employment throughout the year. Because nobody gets continuous employment, there are gaps, and they would like to use these gaps in getting employment. Second thing is, where do they go from here? Now, the answer would be that this program is continuing, and as far as the present situation is concerned, there is no end seen right now. So they will continue working on these programs. But again, going back to the experiences at different levels, you know, for example, village Raligarh Sindhi, or the village SAM which we conducted, or some NGO experiences, where they have seen that the moment you provide irrigation, water harvesting, etc., the agricultural crops increase from 1 to 2 or 3, and that increases the mainstream employment. And when the mainstream employment increases, people get absorbed into that and they don't need. There are several examples like this where employment guarantee is not needed because of that. But that brings to the other question which you asked, whether employment guarantee is a permanent thing or non-permanent thing. You know, employment guarantee is for two kinds of things. One is for structural unemployment and for promoting economic growth. Second is for facing crisis. So even when you have achieved a level where labor absorbing capacity of the mainstream is reasonably good, there could be crisis, there could be ups and downs. So employment guarantee could be used for that purpose also. Now, for developing countries at this stage, the employment guarantee which helps in the development process is more important, and that's why we are looking at it from that point of view. You had another question regarding capital-intensive growth. What will be the future of capital-intensive growth? It's very difficult to say. We had this discussion earlier also in one of the sessions. And, you know, personally, I believe that if you want to think in terms of development of all the countries, then one has to think in terms of limits to global growth. And if all developing countries are expecting to reach American lifestyle or developed countries' lifestyle, then it's not going to happen. It's true. So one has to think in terms of a development model which is good for developing countries, and they can show a development model. They can project, illustrate a way of growing a development path which can be acceptable, which can be sustainable in the long run. And I would think that there is a chance for developing countries to show this model rather than going in for mad rush for consumerism. So this is something which I would consider very important. And lastly, you talked about the unemployment rates. Now, unemployment rates in India are, there is seasonal unemployment. So in the peak season, there is considerable employment, sometimes full employment in some villages. And when there's a lean season, then employment goes down, and then people try to find out some other work or they are unemployed. So this seasonal thing can be taken care of by this one thing. Secondly, there are intermittent employment also. It's not employment is continuous. So those intermittent gaps of 15 days, 1 month here and there can be filled in by that. But if you're talking about the rates, then unemployment rates in India would be quite low, particularly rural areas, less than 5%. 7.5%. But it depends on what. All the three.
Usual status.
The usual status is, 10%, yeah. So the employment growth, unemployment rates have increased recently in the sense that open unemployment has come up, and that will also be taken care of by this to a considerable extent. But the underemployment also is something which is important, which can be taken care of by employment guarantee programs.
Just very quick on whether you need ELR just for the structural, beyond that, is it only something for a crisis or is it something that has to be permanent? I think it has to be permanent. In the United States, we have, if you want to define it that way, we always have a crisis for blacks, Hispanics, high school dropouts, people with disabilities, and workers over age 55. We always have a crisis, even at business cycle peaks. So you have to have a permanent program. Mm-hmm.
Given that we have four potential respondents, if the audience can keep their comments and questions pointed, we have a lot of interest, and we can always move the discussion to dinner as well.
Thanks very much. You know, this has been such a fascinating session that I'm sure the discussion is going to continue into dinner. So I want to thank all of you. It's been really, really interesting. I just wanted, you know, this issue of financing, because it keeps coming up. I think people don't realize how cheap employment schemes are. I mean, the most expensive one you mentioned is 1% of GDP. In India, we're still spending 0.6% of GDP. Having employed, having created 140 million work days last year. And that, I don't think you should just look at it in terms of spending. There was this issue, Mariam, you were asking about, you know, because actually you give away much more in tax cuts. The Indian government last year gave away 3% of GDP in tax cuts, okay? That is what gives your fiscal deficit that problem. So I think when we're looking at this, we're always counterposing this spending versus some other spending, whereas a tax cut is equivalent to spending because it's actually giving away money to corporates and so on. So I think that's one important point. Second, I just want to, I completely agree with all the, and by the way, Rania, also this work thing, I completely agree with you about, you know, the empowerment of work per se, no matter how terrible the conditions. Having said all that, I think we have to just recognize the political constraints to these things. I mean, there are reasons why there is such a backlash, and the reasons are deeply political because it's fundamentally about income distribution. Yes. There's no question that this affects distributive shares. This affects the wage shares of workers. It affects their bargaining power, and that's why there are all these other non-reasons which do not stand in economic theory, but which are constantly propounded. And that's why these schemes don't get to last very long. That's why even in India, it's basically very arduous physical earthwork, which even women are forced to do. That's why in Argentina, it gets phased out, because there's a deep political backlash vis-a-vis the wage share. But I think in addition, there is another political angle, which is the ideological dislike of public employment. And that's one of the reasons why you get the cash transfer model, because the cash transfer model is you hand over the cash and they go to the private provider. So I think there is the second thing which we have to also fight for, which is the recognition that public employment also can be a positive thing. Thanks.
Thank you very much. I mean, it's a really fascinating discussion, and thank you again for that reminder about the tax cut on spending. I think for me, I wanted to take the issue back to a broader issue of establishing an ethical and normative framework for around which these are built, so that they don't become these kind of ghettoized things that drops out every now and picks up again. So I think for me, I'm always arguing that we need to go back to the fundamental question of what is the economy for? What is a good society and how do we achieve it? And that then brings us to the question of rethinking not only development, but rethinking about issues of social contract. What are the underpinning things within the society that give rise to government having an obligation to use counter-cyclical fiscal and monetary policy regardless of external constraints? And I think the point that Butch made earlier, which is that we need to then be mindful of and start linking our work with the work that's emerging from the linkages of from the embodiment and development of economic and social rights, and grounding our policies within the context and the framework of commutative and distributive justice are really fundamental, I think, for us. And I'd like to bring to the table not just the fact that the employer of last resort scheme exists, but there's a whole set of alternatives that social movements are articulating in Brazil and in Latin America, which is a social economy network, or the social economy or the solidarity economy, where in the case of Argentina, the city of Rosario actually has adopted the social economy and the social solidarity economy model, which includes a wide range of diverse activities, including workers' co-op, ESOP, local currencies in the U.S., the Berkshire and other currencies, which was written about in the U.S. News and World Report. A whole bunch of things that people are articulating in Quebec. The whole municipality has gone into this. And I think municipality in the U.S., in Detroit and others, are being forced because of the financial constraint to develop local currencies, which is not a new reality. It's just that people have gone back to it to figure ways of financing and getting at what they want. So what I would argue for is a range of complementarities, including the employee of last resort, but it has to be girded in a framework that obligates and have us discuss the question of what citizenship is, what economic rights are, and what are the various kinds of social contracts. And there are going to be multiple social contracts in different countries, especially some places as big as India and even Argentina. So I'd like for us to go back to that. I wanted to flag that in the broad context of thinking of the ethical framework, for those of you who are so inclined, I would refer you to the encyclical, which came out yesterday from the Pope, which I'm not used to quoting the Pope, but but I thought, you know, that it, given the interest and the influence of the OLC, especially in the context of some UN negotiation, that it was interesting that here in the encyclical, which came out on Tuesday, today's Wednesday, right, basically argued for locating finance, production, resource, and consumption in a moral and ethical framework, and that every economic decision has a moral consequence, which is the point that Niloufer has been making over and over since we got here, and that we can't simply propose our projects in abstraction without grounding it into these kinds of frameworks that are able to motivate and inspire social movements and others to move forward on these projects.
Let me qualify one more about my case, about your comments, Rania. You see, our countries went through socialist, and now we are moving to capitalist. So we have this experience that remainder countries are going slightly, you see. And if we had in our room just policymakers or IMF policymakers or something like that, I would stress strictly women employment, creating the opportunities for women to be involved in labor market, and so on, so on. But whenever we are all here, women activists, feminist economists, and so on, who do care about women's rights, I take our case because to give you, how to say, ground for consideration, to consider those consequences and those challenges that would be arise if we straight will go through just employment of women. For instance, whenever in the society women are totally occupied by their job and there is equal job opportunities for men and women and so on and so on, what is happening with children, even if there is child care facilities and infrastructure in the society? That may increase criminality in the country, that may increase child health diseases in the society, and this will transfer for society in costs and expenditures and for state budget as well. So we should very, very carefully when creating women empowerment policy to take into consideration all aspects that may arise in future. You see, that was my comment and I'd say my experiences to learn from our experience that we already have and that the problems that we now are facing.
Just to make sure that I understood your question, the statement. Were you saying that what happens? Were you asking what happens when women get work, get to have employment, but there are no childcare centers, or there are? Okay. Can I respond to that? Yeah. No. I understand.
Attention to their children.
It was very interesting to me in the last CSW, in one of the meetings that I attended. The minister of Sweden, I think he was Minister of Health, but I'm not quite sure, I cannot recall that detail. And he said there have been, in many instances, questions as to what happens to children when they are raised through early childhood development centers and kindergartens instead of having their mothers raise them. And he said, this was a question of my generation and before, because now the majority of men in Sweden that are holding high positions, that are the teachers and the surgeons and are in all places in society, as well as the women, have been raised actually through childcare centers, and they are doing fine. So the question has stopped being asked. So in some ways, what I'm trying to say is that it is one thing to say that women should have the option, like families should have the option. It is a different story to say that families and women know how to raise children better. I really have serious doubts about that, because early childhood development, especially in among populations that suffer from lack of health and lack of nutrition, it is not just having children around. It is really having all the psychological and the physical requirements in place that human beings require. So in a way, a woman as I am and as mother as I could be, I cannot romanticize childhood and motherhood. Some women will raise their children beautifully, and others will not. So it is not about ability and capability. It is about options and about not coming up with this, you know, overarching, families are the best place to raise children. So it is really about creating alternatives and kinds of options. Yes, exactly. Exactly. So this is exactly sort of what we, I think, all of us here would be advocating for. Yeah?
Zero. I'm not going to answer to anything anymore.
In fact, I was also worried. I almost dropped out of the questions. I have a few comments to make. I think I also would like to, again, reflect generally about why is it that the economic growth generally is not generate employment. You know that Rania made a statement, which is also very much, how can I say, crux of the matter, I think, if you look at the overall crisis situation that Rania mentioned. And I think this is also, in my thinking, very much linked to the fact that the inequality is increasing, whereby workers are not getting the, you know, proportionately to, you know, productivity growth and within the overall profit that the companies make, which is not just limited to industrialized country situation, but, you know, the Jayati has done a very interesting paper on this issue as well in India. And I think this is something I think we need to all think about, because clearly the, you know, the guarantee employment as a last resort should in principle be the last resort in the cases of consistent job crisis or high continued unemployment situation in many of the developing countries. And I also have a comment on the financing of this kind of program. And in developing countries, fiscal space is, of course, much smaller. But in the case of countries like U.S., I don't know how the U.S. is financing, how the stimulus package per se is, you know, being financed. But typically in more old, you know, core European countries, they normally finance this kind of, this is considered more like active labor market policy. So it should be financed not from the government, you know, core government budget, but should be coming from the envelope that is, you know, being contributed to by employers, workers, and also government. You see? It's a different envelope. So I just want to distinguish this point. All the time we talk of just a percentage GDP, but I think the financing could be differently done. And last but not least, I think this kind of guarantee schemes should really be framed in the overall employment policy in a national development framework. That you need to have multiple intervention policy interventions from the also dealing with the supply side constraints. Like there could be a skills mismatch in the labor market. That could be the cause of it. And of course, some, you know, the policy, more conducive policy environment for enterprise development, especially small enterprise development. The same thing also goes to access to credit and all that. There are a whole gamut of series of things that I did briefly mention in my presentation that should be complemented together with this kind of guarantee scheme, I think. Thank you.
Well, I guess the first thing I want to say is that this is about to be, I want to get some idea from you are involved in this discussion. When do the Bretton Woods institutions take this over, right? It's like a good idea that they're, you know, just like debt relief, and then they turn it around and they switch it into something. And let me ask some questions basically that arose for me, given that you were going to target it, right? To what extent is this just going to be a different kind of welfare program, right? If you were going to target it, to what extent is it? It's not really a macroeconomic program that you think it is, right? A cheap one. Maybe it doesn't. It's not very expensive, right? But what does it really mean, right? In terms of when are you going to lose the idea that this is a guarantee of employment of last resort that is available to everybody? And therefore, it's a different kind of approach, a different kind of policy proposal.
Add on to the point raised by Naoko and also Mariama, with regards to the broader framework in which this employment guarantee scheme need to be situated. I'm going to address the first part of the title of this session, which is the right to work, and also the last part, which is gender inequality. I think one of the things that people have learned in this course is that there is really a need to look at paid work also in the context of the total work, which involves unpaid work. I mean, that's from a gendered perspective. In which case, careful thinking of what it involves to not address the issue of the double burden is very important. It's very easy to say, okay, let's just open daycare. I think there was some discussion done on daycare policies in terms of the private level. But whose responsibility is it? And also, secondly, on the issue of gender inequality, promoting just any type of employment creation can maintain certain types of gender inequities. To the extent that, for example, division of labor within the household, the unequal division of responsibilities inside the household, continue to persist. And it is possible that will continue to persist. Are there issues, it's worthwhile thinking, what type of employment policies that can address this issue, for example, providing incentives for men to take as much as women in doing care work. And you've seen slowly and gradually in certain cultures and certain societies that this has actually been changing and shifting. I think it's important. The reason I say it is the point raised by Butch
also, it's like microcredit. Microcredit, when it was introduced, was like, you know, the golden egg type of thing. It was a solution to A, women's empowerment, because it produced more earnings, and it also increased employment for women, poor women, okay, with no assets whatsoever. However, we also see now, after the long decades of experience on microcredit, the limitations of microcredit. And I think we need also to be both tactical, but also strategic in how we view employment guarantee scheme. And I think that's very important. The second point I'd like to raise is the issue of quality of employment. The right to work must also include the word decent. It has to be that. And it's also important to examine how this employment guarantee scheme affect, not affect, transform the other types of jobs in the economy, to what extent it enhances and increases, not just in terms of earnings, but in working conditions. I think that's very important. At least in my study, I think the quality of employment is just as important as creating employment. Thank you.
Oh, are we ready? Who's going first?
We've gone to 7 o'clock before. Nothing new. Yeah. Okay. I promise not to speak. So.
Okay.
I'm being silenced.
Okay. Let me start. You know, this ethical framework, which Mariama talked about, I would like to mention here the kind of work which is being done by human rights people. You know, human rights and economic development. There is an effort to link these two things up, and Diane and Radhika's work is pioneering work in this context. At the same time, in addition to that, you know, there is also a discussion going on about human dignity, which is there, and we had attended this meeting as to what is the ultimate goal of economic development, if it's human rights or human dignity. What kind of economic development path will lead to that? This is something which is very important that needs to be strengthened further. This is one thing I think is very important, because what is the goal of development needs to be specified. As far as double burden is concerned, I think double burden of women can be reduced in two ways. One, by shifting it to the market or to the government or whatever. And second is sharing. And both the things are equally important. By shifting this work to government or to private sector or to the market, etc., is not adequate. Though it is important, it is not adequate. Sharing work within the household is extremely important. And here I remember the work that was done in UNDP about equal sharing of work, equal sharing of responsibilities by men and women. We had this group and we came out with some recommendations where there are certain important implications of sharing of this work, equal sharing of this work, for labor market policies also. That apart from giving just paternity leave, etc., one has to also think in terms of working hours and sharing of work by men, and reducing pressure of work or ceiling of work by men also. This is something which is important, because you cannot assume that men will do full-time work and women will do part-time work and women will do compressed week and women will do home-based work, etc., etc., and that is a sharing. That doesn't happen. That employment, labor market policies also need to focus on equal sharing of work between men and women. I'll end here, I think. Yes, just one thing, quality of employment. I fully agree about quality of employment, but when a country has 94% of the workforce not getting social security of desirable level, decent work, then NREGA kind of work can start with this and gradually can graduate into social security and things like that. So it is something which is a path which needs to be taken. You can't start with decent work on employment guarantee scheme like this.
Okay, just a couple of miscellaneous comments. I don't know of any good policies that can tell us how the work within the household gets distributed. What we can do is create conditions that allow women to have bargaining power. So if there are job options and if there are parent-ready jobs, then that is an availability, an option for both men and women. So the way we like to think about the employer of last resort is government setting the standard for wages, setting the standard of work conditions, setting the standard of wage benefit package. If there are parental leaves that go with that package, that becomes suddenly the standard for the private sector as well. And if the parental leave is not maternity or paternity leave of different duration, if it is the same to all men and women, then it does give you a recourse to bargain within the household. And then, so these are just the necessary conditions. With respect to broadening the conversation, there is quite a bit that's done out there, and we just really have got to cross the aisle and talk to each other. There's so much debate on income guarantee and job guarantee, and there's just actually so much conflict, it seems, whereas the goals and objectives are absolutely the same. We have written with Randy on the macroeconomic effects of these policies, so we can't lose sight of that. There are some serious destabilizing features of simple income guarantee policies, and you have to look at those very carefully. Therefore, you can carry this conversation as tying the income benefit or the income guarantee to a participation aspect, so to participation component. So there's a lot of talk on participation income. Hyman Minsky called it the road to participation. He saw the employer of last resort as the road to participation. Harry Boyd has talked on the promise of public work. There is public service employment. There's just so much out there. I think we just need to reorient our thinking about the role of government in this whole conversation. As far as the type of jobs in Argentina, there were examples where women did non-traditional jobs, and then there are examples where women actually got training in very traditional female jobs. So you do want to be very careful. What are the courses that they do? Are they gardening and hairstyling, or are they electrification and carpentry? And there were women that actually had their own carpentry shops and were electricians, etc. So there is a way to do this and without doing it across gender lines. And as a very, very minor point, I just love the point about how cheap employment creation is. I did some very rough back-of-the-envelope calculations on the Obama plan, and for $1 trillion dollars, you can create 20 million jobs at a living wage in the United States. Now talk about full employment and, you know, really eliminating the precarious forms of employment. So, yes, there is, even in according to conventional standards, there's just so much you could do.
Okay. Well, it should be obvious, employer of last resort will not resolve all social problems. It won't even resolve all unemployment problems. It is a higher off the bottom strategy. Okay, if you can't find a better job, you work in this job. So obviously this is not going to by itself put women in the top management jobs. That's not what this program is about. It's about making sure that if you want a job at the minimum wage, hopefully living wage, as I already talked about, it will be available. Now, will this strengthen your position? I think it strengthens your position much more than basic income guarantee. Basic income guarantee, you can tell your employer, give me a raise, give me better working conditions, or I'll quit my job and go home and collect the basic income guarantee. Well, what is that going to be? $1,000 a year? It's not a plausible threat. However, if you have employer of last resort, that can be a plausible threat. So it is going to strengthen workers. Someone mentioned, I can't remember who, the growing inequality and the falling wage share that we see. Okay, I think that there are a whole bunch of forces that are leading to that, but basically it all comes down to the position of workers has been weakened tremendously. Neoliberal policies coming online of about 2 billion people into the world markets, those things have reduced workers' power. This will provide a bit more power at the bottom of the employment ladder, wage scale, whatever. It's going to improve things at the bottom without any question, and it will have some impact near the bottom because you do have a legitimate threat that you've got to offer something at least as good as what I can get in the employer of last resort program. There was a question, if the program is targeted, heads of household, in Argentina it was targeted to low-income heads of household? Is it then something more like welfare? Well, it when we interviewed the government officials, they all said the program stigmatized people because it was a targeted program. Now, as I said in the very beginning, our ultimate goal should be a universal program. No targeting at all. Anyone who wants to work in the program can work in the program. That is one way to reduce the stigmatization. But I can tell you, when Pavlina and I interviewed the workers, the vast majority thought it was a huge improvement in their lives. That they had been much more stigmatized before because they had no paid employment. If they worked at all, it was in the informal sector. So for them, it was a huge improvement. It reduced stigmatization. They were contributing to the community. And I said, we have videos we could show you. Virtually every woman we interviewed thought it was an improvement in their lives because now they were contributing to the community, whereas before they could not do that. The last thing, well, actually two last things. Financing, I'll talk more about that again tonight, but you know, if we want to, we can imagine that it is the tax on payrolls that in the United States pays for Social Security, or in Europe, that it is the tax on workers that pays for the anti-poverty programs. But this is just a myth. I don't think it's a useful myth. I wouldn't want to try to promote a program that way. I think that it generates huge problems. As we see in the United States, we start getting these arguments about, uh-oh, Social Security is going to go bankrupt. We won't be able to afford the retirement program. We're going to have to raise the taxes on workers in order to pay for the program. In truth, the payroll tax does not pay in any way whatsoever for Social Security. And in Europe, those taxes don't in any way pay for the social programs either. Just finally, We should push the right to work. I think it's very important to emphasize this should be a human right. The job guarantee should be a human right. But we also then, of course, have to give the opportunity to work. Without an opportunity to work, the right is meaningless. Employer of last resort is sort of the minimal program you can have that ensures a right to work. It's not enough. You also need to deal with college graduates, much better educated, who are not, who really should not be in the sort of a program. So you need other kinds of employment programs too, but it's a minimum thing. And finally, it gives you the choice of working, and you may choose not to work. And so you may still need other kinds of programs for cases where people maybe very legitimately choose not to work.
I said I'm not going to say anything, and that was not true. I'm going to say something, impossible not to say something. And what I will say is a little bit on the personal side. The first thing I want to say is that I usually sense in conversations with economists, in general, in all fora, a kind of resistance to it. And I want to address a little bit where the resistance comes from. When we think of the government becoming the guarantor of a right, if it is not in that context that we provide the opportunity, what would be the alternative? It is something that we have to think about. If you talk about rights and you want a rights framework, who becomes the guarantor? How does that get negotiated? So to me, it is always about rewriting the social contract, and that social contract is not one that will say the employment of last resort will provide equal opportunities for all, is not one that says it will be the guarantor of equality between men and women, it will eliminate poverty, it will deliver heaven on earth. No, that is not what the program is about. It is a very sort of limited, there is a very limited scope that the program has.
And of course, it will be in coordination with other programs that it can bring about some kind of change, right? So it is not really proposed in South Africa or in India as the one and only solution. And it is not the only solution for one and one reason only, because poverty is a state people find themselves in for a variety of reasons. And unless we understand the process that brings us to poverty, we cannot address it. So if it is land usurpation and marginalization of peasants that is bringing families into despair, I don't want to have, actually, I don't want to propose an employment of last resort program as the solution. The solution lies elsewhere. If it is competition that is coming from abroad and is destroying my industry at home, I don't want to say the framework is okay, but the marginalized workers, the newly fired workers, give them one of these jobs and they will be okay. So I completely agree with you, Naoko, that there has to be a whole rethinking, but part of this whole rethinking must be from our perspective, from my perspective, I should speak only for myself actually, because it is not necessarily a shared view, employment and work and the ability to secure a livelihood must become the center, essentially, of policy discussions. And that has been really thrown out the window. So this is part and parcel of that conversation. And I am told 0, -5, -10, -15. So thank you. Thank you very much.